ジラのサンタクロース赤い帽子がよく似合うお土産いっぱいミニラも一緒ほらほら聞こえる鈴の音
ランランランランランランプレゼント白いお家もにっこり揺れるランランランランランラン鐘が鳴るみんなで歌おうクリスマス
もうもうもうすらは空飛ぶ鳥だ遠い国からやってきたお手手を引っ張り結んで踊る悲しい涙は吹き飛ばせ
ランランランランランランプレゼント怪獣たちの心も弾む雪よくねくねクリスマス雪
よくねクリスマス。 Hello and welcome to episode 10 of the Asian Cinema Film Club, and of course it is a very special episode tonight as we are celebrating our very first ever Kaiju Christmas.I am your host, as always, Elwood Jones from the Dexter DVD Help. And joining me, of course, is my co-host and partner in crime, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Hello, thank you very much.
Some reason I
got my name right.
I had to pause there for a minute. It's like I felt myself like saying Stephen Lever again. And it's like I had to pause and just like correct myself there. So, but obviously, Stephen, tonight we are looking at Kaiju movies again.And this is a very special episode as we put it out to our audience to pick our very first film, which we look at for Kaiju Christmas. Thank you to everyone who obviously voted. If you voted via Facebook or Twitter, we had some great responses in. And the winner was, of course, Destroy All Monsters, which is going to be our featured film for tonight's episode. And I'm very excited about it because it is, of course, one of my favorite Godzilla movies of all time. AndStephen, I'm sure, is absolutely thrilled to be once again talking about giant monster movies. But
well, we're in luck because it's one I'd seen before and it's one I like. So the gods were with us, the gods of Kaiju.
It was looking scary for a minute. It was looking like we were going to be looking at Godzilla vs. Megalon, which had me concerned. I personally voted for War of the Gargantuas, and it seemed for a while that Godzilla vs. Megalon was going to be...what the people wanted us to watch, and then suddenly Destroy All Monsters pulled ahead. So, but thank you everyone to obviously voted, and we will obviously be getting into that in the second half of the show. Before we obviously get onto that, I mean, we're now coming to the end of another year of cinema, and especially for Asian cinema in particular. This year has been particularly strong with companies like Netflix and Amazon in particular really pushing the focus on Asian cinema.I mean, we saw Amazon pick up Park Chan-wook's The Handmaiden. At the same time, they've also picked up the Shaw Brothers catalogue. Certainly when we look at like Netflix has not only gone for their own branded Asian drama series, it's been really great, especially for fans like ourselves of obviously Asian cinema, to see Asian cinema once again riding high on this sort of wave of popularity thatonly seems to be on the increase, which at the moment, especially with sites such as like Crunchyroll, High Five, doing fantastic business, and certainly on the anime side of things, really bringing across some interesting titles. At the same time, we've got channels like Viceland, which are also now bringing across anime blocks and pushing Asian cinema. And just all around, it seems to be this increase of interest in Asian cinema, which is, of course, fantastic to see. But I mean, still, I mean, what's obviously beenyour sort of favorite picks of this year? I mean, what would you say have been like the films that have really sort of stood out to you? Because I've shamefully have been playing catch up most of this year and watching stuff that I should have been watching in previous years. So I've missed out on a lot of current stuff. But obviously, yourself, you're part of Eastern Kicked, you know, the premier Asian cinema website, film review site, shall I say. So, I mean, what has obviously been holding your interest this year?
Okay, well, I've got a collection of things from sort of around the place. I haven't been maybe as on top of releases. So last year I felt was really, really strong. And this year, due to various reasons, I haven't been on top of it. But there have been a handful of films that have impressed me. Pang Ho-chung's Love Off the Cuff, which is one of the few examples of the third film of a trilogy which is actually stronger than the second. Very charming romantic comedy starring Miriam Young and Sean Yu. The previous films, Love in a Puff and I can't remember what the second one was called. Oh, Love in the Buff. Follow these two characters through their trials and tribulations. And Love of the Cuff, I didn't like the second film, Love in the Buff. I thought it was really disappointing, but this one's waited a while and it's really, really entertaining. The other film, which I'm just going on about all over the place, although it is a little divisive, I notice, is The Villainess, starring Kim Ok-bin, which is just a wonderful visual treat for lovers of action movies. Is it the most original thing in the world? Probably not, but it's an incredibly stylish and fun action film that's got a balls to carry out logical conclusion to certain events which many films would steer away from, which I guarantee any kind of Western remake wouldn't do, but I'm not going to spoil it now. My favourite film of the year was from Thailand, Natawutpun Priyar's Bad Genius, which is a caper movie set in the world of high school exams. It sounds rather banal, but it's brilliantly executed, brilliantly acted, and I'm a little biased because I was lucky enough to meet the director and interview him a few weeks ago, and the man's a legend in of himself. But that's my film of the year. Also, obviously, Takashi Miike had a couple of films out this year. I'm not going to go for his 100th film, Blade of the Immortal, but I really enjoyed the Mole Song Hong Kong Capriccio, which is a sequel to his film from 3 or 4 years ago called The Mole Song. It's a ridiculous, over-the-top comedy in the best random stylings of Miike at his greatest. I found that hugely enjoyable. You mentioned the streaming services, and you obviously mentioned about things that were picked up, like The Handmaiden by, I think it's Amazon.
Yeah.
But Netflix went one higher and actually produced and distributed the fabulous Bong Joon-ho's Okja, which sort of a delightful sort of fable to conservation and vegetarianism, I suppose, with some of his favorite Western actresses and actors like Tilda Swinton and Jake Gyllenhaal, but really entertaining, really enjoyable. Also caused a bit of a fuss in Cannes for being a Netflix film and has probably changed all the rules about how Cannes deals with films. And just two DVDs and Blu-rays which were released this year, because I do feel quite often all we ever get is horror films and martial arts movies. But I think it was Eureka put out Kiyoshi Kurosawa's Creepy earlier in the year. Really interesting thriller film by, again, one of my favourite directors and someone that we're going to talk about in the future, I guarantee it. And the same director's film, a much older film, Pulse, which I know that both I and Zoe were going on about in our Halloween episode but never actually getting to talk about, was given a Arrow film release earlier this year, which for me was one of most exciting things ever, because I never thought that would get a Western release. I've got a Japanese DVD I got probably about 15 years ago now, and to see that in pristine Blu-ray with a decent set of extras is an absolute pleasure. So that's my year in review.
Yeah, I mean, Okja, I've still yet to see. Obviously, I was at this, obviously being a Netflix exclusive, but it makes me kind of interested to see it as well. I mean, I wasn't a huge fan of his most popular sort of film to date, obviously The Host, which I know a lot of people really raved about, but I never got what the appeal was. Obviously, us being Brits means that we have never seen Snowpiercer, because it had one showing at Edinburgh Film Festival, and it's never been seen since on these shores. Do you think that the success of Okja means that we might eventually see a release of Snowpiercer?
I can only hope so. I mean, I was lucky enough, I had to go all the way to Hong Kong to watch it, which is a bit extravagant, isn't it? And I didn't only go to watch that. That just happened. And I've got the German Blu-ray of it, which is fine, but I just find it really weird. And I was hoping, I think we spoke about this before Okja came out, I was kind of hoping that maybe that would, two things would come out of that. One is we'd maybe finally get Snowpiercer, although if it's under the auspices of Harvey, we might never see it, I suppose. And I was also, you know, I'm also excited to see a premier Asian director getting a international platform like Netflix. So we can only hope that one of the others, probably one of the other Korean directors, gets a chance to do something like that, because I believe it was fairly successful. I have mixed feelings about it, but I think it's an important step for Asian cinema to just have that platform.
Certainly, Villainess has been popular when we threw it out to our listeners to obviously pick their favourite films of this year. Certainly, Villainess has frequently come up, and it's easy to understand why. Certainly, it's also one that's really worth picking up at the moment, especially on Amazon, as you can pick it up really cheap. So definitely one to grab while you can. A Taxi Driver also got a mention, as well as Vampire Cleanup Department.
Yeah, I've seen Vampire Cleanup Department. It's a sort of a modern reimagining of the sort of the Mr. Vampire type films, with Baby John as the main star. So if you like your good-looking young Hong Kong actors, that might be one for you. I found it interestingly diverting.
Okay. I'm now starting to realise why Kim recommended it for me. When I posed this question, she was one of the films that she's recommended I watch. Certainly it's on the list of films that I've sort of missed this year. I think this year I've been mainly playing catch-up, although I did actually catch Sion Sono's Tag when it came out on DVD recently, which, while it's certainly not on the same level as the likes of Tokyo Tribe or Why Don't You Play in Hell, is still interesting enough to make it worth a watch. Certainly he's really got a fascination with murdering schoolgirls, it would seem. And certainly the opening featuring the Evil Dead style wind that randomly cuts this school bus full of schoolgirls in half, being like up there with Suicide Club for just the sheer amount of people he can eviscerate in one scene. The actual mechanics of the film, I think, let it down slightly, as it felt like if you're having these complex, like butterfly effect style mechanics in your universe, it probably isn't the best idea to have a schoolgirl explain it, as it doesn't seem to really sort of gel. But certainly it's a film with some interesting moments throughout, and I think it's one certainly worth watching, especially if you are a fan of Sion Sono. I think there's certainly much to enjoy, even though it's probably not his best work to date.
Yeah, I saw it a while ago, and I liked it enough to pick it up when it came out this year, as you say. I think it's So it's from his really busy year. He had a couple of years back where he did seven or eight films at the same time, which are all slowly seem to be coming over to these shores in various ways and forms. I recently caught up with Anti-Porno, which is another one of those films, which we might talk about another time. But they both, to me, have the same flaw that they seem to be wanting to place a critical commentary on something. So in Tag's case, maybe the depiction of women in certain sorts of films, and in Anti-Porno even more so, it's trying to be a critique on romantic pornography films from the 70s, and it ends up being everything I think it's trying to criticize. It seems a little they both seem a little self-defeating, but they're both entertaining enough, and they've got some fun moments.
Yeah. Mubai justified its subscription fee for myself, as they showed the complete Dead or Alive trilogy from Takashi Miike, which meant, especially for myself, I finally got to see the third film in the trilogy, which has been notoriously difficult here in the UK to get hold of. And it originally was going to be released through Tartan, who released, obviously, Dead or Alive and Dead or Alive 2 Birds. And then, unfortunately, the company went under before they were able to release Dead or Alive Final. And I have to say that while a lot of people really rave about Dead or Alive 2, it really did nothing for me. It felt, in many ways, like Beat Takashi's Solentine or Boiling Point, those sort of Yakuza movies he did, where it's more about these characters going on a journey or their interactions themselves than the film that you expect to be getting. Dead or Alive 3 is wonderfully bonkers, and I think the closest we're ever going to see to Takashi Miike doing a Blade Runner-style movie. If it wasn't for the penis robot at the end, I think I would have rated it a lot higher. Certainly by the end of Dead or Alive Final, it just really felt like he didn't know what to do with it. He'd come up with this concept, his two lead actors battling each other across space and time over the course of these three films. And he got to the end of Final and he just had no idea what to do. So he basically thought, oh, you know, just giant penis robot. That's a great way to end this film. And I think for any other director, we would have lambasted it more. But because it's Takashi Miike, we just give him this wide breadth just to throw randomness at the screen. And we go, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, are you a fan of the Dead or Alive film, Stephen? Or,
well, I think we spoke about it a few episodes ago, because I picked up the Blu-ray box set. Was it that I think it's Arrow again put out, because I'd never seen them, and I have still only watched the first one, although I enjoyed the first one hugely in terms of its the opening sequence is just astonishing. You know, that if anyone wants to call Mikey a hack, show him that, show him what he can do with cinema. It's got some disturbing stuff in it, and it's got an ending that you won't predict. I think it's fascinating. And I will watch the other two, although you've made me, you may have put it down the list a bit by having a go at the last one a little bit there.
No, I mean, the last one I really enjoyed. I mean, the last one I would say is, it's not as bonkers as the first one, but it's as fun. The second one, I know in Letterboxd, I seem to be in this very small minority of people who perhaps didn't enjoy it as much as everyone else apparently did. I don't know whether my recommendations ever take off, but certainly the original Dead or Alive, it's essentially Takashi Miike doing Heat, the Michael Mann movie, but, you know, better and more enjoyable and hell of a lot shorter. But, I mean, this is a movie where you see people snorting, like, 100 meters of coke in one scene. There's people having throat slits and thrown off buildings and having exploding stomachs of noodles flying at the screen. And this is all in the first, 10 minutes of the film? He, like, throws more violence and gore at the screen than most directors manage in a whole runtime of their film. And he's only really just getting started, because this is, like, really Miike at the height of his powers in the Outlaw period. I mean, it's just, I think the only thing that's above it, really, would be if you looked at Ishii the Killer. I think Ishii the Killer is the only film in his filmography which perhaps tops it. Maybe to an extent his Masters of Horror episode imprint. But Dead or Alive just remains his bonkers entry on his resume. And certainly if you want to see Mike at the height of his powers in the Outlaw Pit, then Dead or Alive is definitely the way to go. And I think if you watch that one, then definitely check out the other two, because they're perhaps not as bonkers, but the two leads that he obviously features are just so charismatic and interesting to watch that it's just, you're just all the more grateful for the fact he carried them across for the other two films and just made this trilogy of really sort of interesting cinema. But other than that, I mean, I've still got to watch Train to Busan, I've still got to watch Soul Station. But, you know, Christmas is coming up. Maybe I'll get them scratched off over then, so.
Yeah, no, Train to Busan, excellent. Soul Station, excellent. I think you mentioned The Handmaiden, which I thought was okay. So it's from some of the, certainly if we consider things that are sort of coming out here in the West, and certainly in the UK, there's a strong selection. I just don't know what's coming next.
Yeah, I mean, it's always hard to say what's going to come next because, I mean, if we look at Tag, for example, I mean, that was released 2015 in, obviously, it's native country, and then it's, 2017 when we finally get a release for it? It's a little frustrating. I mean, we do obviously have the promise of Ip Man 4 coming out from Donnie Yen. Are you excited for another Ip Man?
I thought the first Ip Man was a lot of fun. I thought the second Ip Man was fantastic until the end. I went to see the third Ip Man at the cinema in 3D, and I was taken out of it a bit by Mr. Tyson's appearance, although it made some sense. But it felt like a film too far. I have no desire to see an Ip Man 4, especially when there's a perfectly good... there's another Ip Man film. Is it Herman Yao's one with Anthony Wong in it, which is actually even better than the other two in terms of a film. So no, I'm not overly excited, but Donnie Yen has become a very watchable performer and probably with age has become a bit more of a screen presence as an actor. So
yeah,
I'll watch it, but it's not something I was screaming out for.
I know. I mean, we do seem to be still in this period of exploitation movies, which I would have thought would have died to death by now. But I think thanks to Donnie Yen keep making these Ip Man movies, it somehow keeping the whole trend going. This is something I don't... When I hear, obviously, Anthony Wong playing the role, I'm not sure, obviously, whether how that would actually work out. Because, I mean, he's not, obviously, a traditional martial artist. So how does it, obviously, work out in terms of the role of him playing Ip Man?
It's more of a dramatic thing. It's at the end of his, it's almost more of a tale of him and his wife's relationship, which is hinted at, I think, in the Donnie Yen vehicles. But it's Herman Yao, you know, he of, what's it called? And with Anthony Wong, God, what's it called? The one with the Ebola syndrome. You know, it's that pairing, but they've all both grown up and they've made something else. But, you know, it's a charming, lovely film rather than a martial arts-centred drama, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's obviously 2017. I mean, obviously, if there's been something that caught your interest and that we haven't obviously discussed, please let us know. You can let us know either on the Twitter, which is at Asian Cinema. Sorry, yeah. You can let us know on the Twitter, which is at AC Film Club. You can also let us know on Facebook, and we are also got the email as well, which is acfilmclub@yahoo.com. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, though, we're going to be looking at our featured film for this evening, which, of course, is the Godzilla classic, Destroy All Monsters.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Cinema Recall Podcast here at ThatMomentIn.com. I am your host, Laverne, and on each episode, myself, along with a guest, we'll be talking about an iconic scene from a classic movie. Which films will we be discussing? Well, that's all up to you, because before each episode airs, we are going to be giving you a poll of great flicks to choose from. Whichever one gets the most votes, that's the one we'll be talking about. So, listen to the Cinema Recall podcast on the site thatmomentin.com, or on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or Podomatic, or SoundCloud. Thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy it.
Idol.
And we're back. Yours, you're still listening to the Asian Cinema Film Club. Tonight is, of course, the very first inaugural Kaiju Christmas. And we are going to be looking at Destroyer Monsters. So thank you again to everyone who voted and chose the very first selection for Kaiju Christmas. And yeah, Destroyer Monsters is an absolutely fantastic choice to kick off Kaiju Christmas, really. Before we obviously get into the film, though, if you haven't done already, please do follow us on Facebook. We are on Twitter. We are on Instagram. You can also get our complete archive via our website. The link is available in the section below. We are also on also part of the thatmomentin.com podcast network. So if you go to thatmomentin.com, you can find our full archive on there as well. Also, if you're listening to us on Podomatic or iTunes or Stitcher, wherever you happen to be listening to us, please leave us a rating, leave us some comments. It's all appreciated and certainly helps to get the show out there and expand the audience listener base. And we appreciate everyone who's obviously been supporting the show since we started. It's been an absolute joy to bring these episodes and certainly share our love of Asian cinema and expand our own interest in this world and provide this sort of introduction to Asian cinema. So we appreciate everyone who's obviously supported the show so far, and hopefully you continue to do so. But obviously, Destroyer Monsters, this is, as I said before, this is one of my favorite Godzilla movies of all time. And this was the 9th Godzilla movie to be released. And at the time, it was seen as a way to mothball the series, as the interest in the Godzilla franchise had been declining slowly. And Toho basically saw this as a way to send the series out on a high. And it went on to obviously become one of the most popular Godzilla movies of all time. And basically went on to spawn another 29 movies in its wake. Now, released in 1968, this is the last film to feature all of the Godzilla Godfathers. In Japan, it's also known as Attack of the Marching Monsters. And basically, the film sees all the monsters of the world being rounded up and put onto this island known as Monster Island. And here, the monsters can live in peace and, you know, Japan doesn't have to worry about rampaging monsters coming along and destroying everything. And this is all going great until a mysterious mist covers the island and causes all the monsters to disappear. As we soon find out that the monsters are now under the control of a race of mind-controlling aliens known as Kalax, who have got their sights set on destroying all human life using the giant monsters they now have under their control. Stephen, I mean, this is the second Kaiju movie I've made you watch since we started this podcast. You said you've seen this one, obviously, before, when we talked about it a little earlier in the show. I mean, what's your sort of opening thoughts on Destroyer Monsters? I mean, how did you find this one?
Well, actually, it's not only one I've seen before, it's one I've actually reviewed before over on Guaylo Ramblings. And so, spoilers, I really liked it. I found it really enjoyable. The first time I watched it, of course, I had no idea who all these other monsters were. I knew about Godzilla, but yeah, all the others. So it was kind of interesting in the 2 years since I last watched it that my own kaiju movie knowledge has been built up. Maybe not to your level, sir, but considerably. So it made things made a little more, the hell yeah moments maybe a little more, meant a little more to me. You know, it's a fun romp. It's a huge amount of fun with some interesting things we could pick holes in. So it's made in what, 1968, set in the future of about the turn of the century, which is our past, which apparently the world is run by the UN, which again is something I brought up when we were talking about King Kong versus Godzilla. And so it's obviously a thing that was going on in that time that people thought that single world government was going to happen. And also a whole bunch of Japanese people who were taking their art direction from Devo. with the yellow outfits and the bucket heads and things like that. But, you know, you could easily pick holes in some of the model work and some of the acting and the guys in the suits. But you know what? You put that to one side, it's a huge amount of fun. It's got a couple of draggy bits. There's one moment in particular with the laser beam that just seems to drag on forever. But I know a lot of people think, oh, it's just great for that final reel where all the monsters have a big fight with King Ghidorah. But actually, I think there's a lot more going on than that. It's fun. It's what these films should be. It doesn't take itself too seriously. No, you'd have to be pretty stone-hearted not to enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things going for this film. I mean, obviously, this is set in a very alternate version of 1999. I have to say that their vision of 1999 still looks exactly the same as the year it was shot. I mean, the fact this film has going for its advantage is that, in fact, we have all five of the Godzilla fathers. So we've got Taka, Tsuburaya, who is obviously the legend, especially in kaiju movies, doing all the model work, all the costumes, all the monster suits. And I mean, he would obviously go on to do things such as like Ultra Q, Ultraman. And we got Isho Honda, who I think when it came to shooting kaiju movies in particular, really had a grasp of what worked. I mean, again, we get to the low angles, we get to really get a sense of scale, which is sort of key to making these movies work. And certainly we saw it in likes of the original Godzilla and Mothra. He really knew how to make these monsters look impressive. And when we look at the new Pacific Rim movie and how the film is being shot, you can really see the importance on where his influence worked and how, especially when we look at the original Pacific Rim movie, because they take a lot of inspiration from the way he shoots these films. So you really get a sense of scale. And certainly when I was looking at the new Pacific Rim film, it looked like a Transformers movie because they're shooting at such a high angle. There's no sense of scale. And here, Isho Honda actually gets to branch out a bit and not just do Tokyo. He gets to obviously shoot scenes in New York, in Moscow, and destroy a few different cities around the world. And we also have Ikafumba and Nakajima also putting in their sort of last appearances on the series. And it's kind of sad when we obviously look at the fact that neither of these, any of these five men are no longer sadly with us. And they really are working at the top of their game here with this film. In particular, I mean, Toho, I think, are pretty legendary for how they love to recycle monsters in particular. Certainly, we would see suits from the Godzilla movies being recycled in the Ultraman series. Often, the actors would be inside the suits when they respray painted them, which says a lot about Japanese health and safety. But you mentioned already, I mean, the sheer amount of monsters that we have in this movie. I mean, we've got not only monsters from the Godzilla series, so you've got Mothra, Rodan, Anglis, my personal favorite. We've got Kumonga, also known as Spiger, which is the giant spider. We also have Manila, God, who still looks like a grey lumpy mash. We've also got, as I said, we've got appearances from monsters that were nothing to do with Godzilla, and we're just part of the Toho back catalog. So you've got Baragon, who was in Frankenstein Conquers the World, Gorosaurus from King Kong Escapes, Manda, who was in Atragon, and we've got Varan from Varan the Unbelievable, who, for some reason, never seems out of place. And, I mean, it kind of was a relief, the fact that King Kong didn't show up, especially after that horrible-looking King Kong costume that we saw in King Kong versus Godzilla. And the sheer scale only Manta Monsters featured on the screen here. I mean, it wasn't until Godzilla Final Wars in 2004 that we actually saw this many monsters on the screen at one time. And somehow it works. It just becomes this incredibly fun romp where you get to see all your favorite monsters destroying cities and then finally teaming up together to fight King Ghidorah in this epic final battle that, for myself, ranks as one of the high points in the Godzilla franchise as a whole. I mean, how did you find, obviously, the man in suit work here? The kaiju effects that are at play here? Because I personally think it still has its charm. I mean, this is a movie from the 60s, and it still looks great. And I think it has a lot to obviously do with the fact that we've got a genius like Totoro here doing the miniature work, that it doesn't seem cheap and tacky. It has that same sort of charm that like the Gerry Anderson productions like Thunderbirds and Stingray have.
I mean, absolutely. When I was watching it, I was thinking this feels like a, especially sort of the opening sequence where the spaceship pointlessly goes to the moon and then comes back straight away. it's got real echoes of sort of the Gerry Anderson sci-fi stuff. So, you know, Captain Scarlet, Thunderbirds, like you say, Joe 90, things like that. So the model work, again, isn't too bad. Some bits I was really impressed with. I don't know the name of the monster, the one that's like a great big snake, attacks like a monorail type thing. That stuck in the mind. It goes to the moon, as I say. Battles in the cities, or not battles, you know, rampages in the cities.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then at the end, you have a whole bunch of guys in rubber suits kicking the crap out of each other, including another hilarious jump kick, which is always one of my favorites for one of these things, just thinking, gosh, if that really happened. And as you say, it gives them, you know, by using the model work, by using the low looking up camera angles, you get a sense that these guys are great big huge monsters. And it doesn't, that there are occasional points, the jump kick I just mentioned as an example, which kind of ruins the illusion a bit. But on the whole, I think it's absolutely fine. You know, this is 1968 or 69 this was made. I don't think, what would the alternative have been? Would have been a Harryhausen style stop motion?
I would imagine so. I mean, that's your only alternative. If you're not going to put a man in a suit, then your only alternative is to do it in stop motion, which again has its problems because there are obviously few masters of the craft. I mean, obviously Harryhausen's probably the most notable, one of the most notable names in the field, but certainly when it came to Japanese cinema, it's certainly more popular to put a man in a suit. I mean, it's still seen as the way to do these effects. I mean, when they were obviously posing, doing Final Wars, and they were like saying, oh, are we going to do CGI effects? And like, no, we're going to do man in a suit effects because this is the way it's always been done.
Shin Godzilla, or Godzilla Resurgence as it was known, although it's CGI now, they did it so it looked like a man in a suit. You know, it's part of the language of the film.
Yeah.
So, or of the genre. So if you as a audience watcher can get over that and accept that as a convention of the genre, it doesn't become distracting at all. I may have been a little dismissive about these films earlier on, but you know, they're hugely enjoyable science fiction action films, aren't they? And a bit like wrestling in a way, where you know, you pick your favorites and you follow those people along, and it's exciting to see somebody that you've seen five films before, or people that you know. I don't know what you think of Manila, but I hope it's negative. I mean, but But I can follow Manila through 3, 4, 5 films, and to the point where in Final Wars, his character starts making some sense.
Yes. Some. I mean, in Final Wars, we have a character with a gun who doesn't use it on Manila. Yeah. It's like, finally, all our problems can be solved. The thing with Manila, though, is that when we obviously like look at Godzilla versus Destroyer, where the baby Godzilla replaces the adult Godzilla, who obviously suffers a meltdown in that movie, and we see the baby Godzilla turn into a full-grown Godzilla. And certainly when we look at Final Wars, we've obviously had the scene of Godzilla final making his peace with Japan and walking off into the sunset with his son. His son being the unlikely peace broker between Godzilla and Japan. So God knows how that worked.
I like that. I added a bit of heart to the Flash.
But I mean, look, I think the character of Godzilla, I mean, in many ways, I always like to say that Godzilla's, the soul of this character really comes across, and I mean, it's really the performance put by Haruo Nakajima, who was one of the original suit actors for Godzilla. I mean, he took on the role, I mean, he played the role right through to, like, Godzilla versus Gigan. I mean, he was pouring out a cup of sweat between takes. I mean, there's those wonderful pictures of him wearing the legs of the Godzilla suit while being poured a cup of tea between shoots. And the fact that he brought this so many different moves to this character, who could just been just like, we could have just seen just doing very sort of basic grab and throw sort of moves, but his dedication to the role, I mean, he strapped explosives to himself and blew himself up on numerous films, and his dedication to the role really brings his character to life, even though, as you said, it's just a man in a suit. But when we look at Godzilla, it's the same as when we look at the Muppets. We see it as being this living, breathing character, not a guy in a suit.
And I think I could give another example. If you've watched the modern Planet of the Apes films, Andy Serkis's performance as Caesar,
yeah,
it's utterly manufactured, but he's brilliant. You know, as you know, it's motion capture. That's the equivalent these days of wearing a suit, right?
Yeah, I would say.
And he brings, obviously, he talks a bit, which helps, but because we won't mention the films where Godzilla talks, but
only once.
We're not going to mention it.
We won't mention the time he flies either, but
no. But you know, I think Andy Serkis deserves an equal amount of credit by bringing to life something which isn't alive. And how many actors can say that?
It's very true. And I mean, all the monsters in this that are featured in this film, they all have their own distinctive personalities. And you really feel for these monsters. I mean, Angulus in particular, I absolutely adore. He has this stupidly comical scene where during the final scene, he grabs hold of King Ghidorah's neck, one of his many heads, should we say, because he is a three-headed dragon, space dragon, and is carried up into the air and dropped from a certain height. And then we see Godzilla put his hand over his face and going, oh my god, what have I got myself into? And it's these little humanizing traits that we obviously saw being put into, especially in the Showa series, which this falls in, where Godzilla was being made more human. We saw the eyes becoming more Asian, especially in like Godzilla and Son. We saw him doing this little jig on the moon in Invasion of the Astro Monsters, and by this point he was very much established as this protector of Earth. He was gone to this protector, even though his idea of protecting Japan meant that he reduced a great portion of it to rubble over the course of the film. But certainly he has a lot of human traits to it, and certainly is very much the case in this film. Obviously, with this film being part of the Showa series, we do obviously have, as you mentioned already, this focus on space travel and aliens, which were very much a recurring theme here. And this film in particular, I mean, we have the crew of the spaceship Moonlight SY-3, who really play quite a major role in this, in particular Captain Yambi, whose fiance has a mind taken over by the aliens, and is basically, he's trying to find a way to snap her back into reality. I mean, how did, you obviously find the, subplot with our brave astronauts who spaceship is not only able to go into space, but able to fly anywhere in the country.
It's a remarkable piece of engineering, isn't it? Especially, it is. As I say, dressed up as Devo, as a Devo tribute act. I think in parts it works. I think you have to have some kind of human story in these films, just to drive the plot along. I think there were moments in it, it got interminable. I talk again about the scene with the laser, and just think, for God's sake, get on with it. And also, cables won't catch fire in the vacuum of space. That's not how fire works. But yeah, again, I don't want to keep picking holes in it. I actually thought that the romantic angle, so with the what's her name, Kyoko. Kyoko gets mind controlled, and she becomes some femme fatale, who also shows you should never wear high heels on the beach. That was another thing that was a bit odd, and draw attention to it. But it kind of, the one thing also that kind of got resolved a bit early for me. There's a whole sort of bunch of stuff about the mind control and the people that are running Monster Island to get under control of the aliens, and nothing really, really happens with that. And I felt there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing that didn't really go anywhere. But we also get Andrew Hughes, who seems, I'm pretty sure, is in one of the King Kong films, isn't he? As your token white man. That's also a scientist. I'm pretty sure that's not too far different to what he's been before, but I think he worked a lot in Japanese cinema in that time. But it's interesting to see a world which is so Japan centric
yeah,
but there's also this sort of almost this token white guy in there. And not only there is a lovely bit, mate, where they start talking about where they find the things which are controlling the aliens. And they say in England, and they show a picture of the White Cliffs of Dover with a big arrow pointing at it. and then in Spain with a big arrow pointing somewhere, and in the Alps underneath a sheet of ice, and it's a giant mountain, and they point a big arrow at the big mountain. There's nothing else to see. There's this wonderfully cheesy bits. And I think that all adds to the charm of it. Yeah. It's not po-faced. Some of the, so I'll criticize the latest Godzilla film, for as much as I entertained, it was incredibly po-faced. And some of the other films I've seen can get really quite, they try and be a bit too serious, or they spend hours on the political side of things and have lots of rooms of people debating for hours on things. So this kind of kept the balance. There's a bit of a sort of 60s, funky 60s thing going on. There's a bit of Anderson going on, as you said. And there's lots of monsters. And yes. I think it all comes together in a pretty nice package. With there's a drinking game in there for the silly bits, but I think you'd be hard, you know, you'd be a hard band to say you weren't entertained by it.
Oh, definitely. It is really entertaining. And as you were saying, when they were talking about the devices that they find scattered around the world, and as you said, we have these wonderful big arrows pointing to stock pictures, and my favorite one being, this one they found inside a coconut. So, like, of all the places you're going to hide it, why a coconut?
I know. I mean, there's so much of it which doesn't make any sense. I just don't want to pick up. One of the things is, it turns out that the aliens are susceptible to cold. So why would they hide it under sheets of ice? How would they have even done that? You know, it's these incredible inconsistencies, almost as if they're making it up as they go along. But this is Japanese cinema, not Hong Kong cinema, so I would hope there's a little bit more to it than that, but who knows?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, also, why does Andrew Hughes sound like such an old man? He's such, oh, my... these monsters. It's like, what the hell's going on with his voice? And it's not like he's been redubbed. I mean, obviously in the original Japanese version, he's redubbed, but in this version, the dub version, it's actually his actual voice. So I don't know what's actually going on with his role, but he did actually appear in quite a few Asian films. I mean, he even turned in a role as Adolf Hitler in Crazy Adventure in 1965. We mentioned already that we saw him in King Kong Escapes, where he played a United Nations journalist. And I mean, he even turned up in Tora 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 as the embassy delegation employee of Japan. So he definitely has a number of appearances throughout Asian cinema. I mean, I think we've seen all his kaiju contributions, though, at this point. But yeah, I think if you're looking for a fun kaiju movie, I don't think you can go wrong with this one. This is probably certainly one of the most fun entries in the franchise. And it really took until Final Wars for it to actually be sort of, I don't want to say bested, but give us something to compare it to, really.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be the inspiration for the next Godzilla movie from the West, is it not?
Yes, I mean, obviously from what we've heard, I mean, we've heard bits and pieces from it. I know Mothra is going to be featured, as well as King Ghidorah has also been hinted. So it'll be interesting to see where they go.
That was a bit of a disappointment that Mothra remained a sort of larval caterpillar thing. I was kind of hoping some wings would spread or those little twin things would turn up. I always love that about Mothra.
Mothra is a very problematic kaiju creation for myself. I mean, she is one of the few female monsters, which is extremely popular with Japanese women, which is why she appears so regularly. At the same time, her magical abilities is that she can either in a adult form, so where she's essentially just the giant moth. She sprinkles you with fairy dust and creates high wind. And in her larval form, we see here, she basically sprays you with silly string. Which it just... I don't know. It doesn't seem overly impressive, but she has her fans. She unquestionably does. I mean, she has her own spin-off saga, for Christ's sake. So
indeed. But I love those two little sort of fairy twin girls that sort of hang around as her guardians, and that's the utter weirdness of that I find charming.
Normally she is obviously accompanied by those foot high twins who act as her sort of guardian. I mean, it's the whole focus of the first Mothra movie. It's the fact that she goes on a rampage just to get them back when they're obviously taken by Jerry Ito's character and with the idea of putting them in this little sideshow attraction. So it was kind of surprising not to see her, but then again, I suppose that they wanted to just focus on the Kallax obviously controlling the monsters and having them go on this rampage, and the fact that when they're free of that control, the monsters obviously just team up together. They recognize each other's and respect each other enough to team up and defeat King Ghidorah. And I have to say, obviously, during that final fight scene, you can see the scene where one of the actors gets past a little overexcited, and when he grabs hold of King Ghidorah's head and throws it down so hard it bounces.
Yeah, the actual bits where they're really ploughing into King Ghidorah do show the suits up and the wire work and the stuff that may or may not be going on. It's there's one bit, one's definitely given a good kicking in there as well. And you go, oh, what if someone got hurt doing that?
So I mean, I just also have to mention that we do obviously see Yukio Kobayashi as the love interest, who we mentioned a little bit earlier. And There's my childhood crush right there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She looks like, oh, no, I'm trying to think who directed Branded to Kill now. Yeah, she looks like she belongs in a Suzume Suzuki movie.
She does. She's so got a cool. Very, yeah, she dresses very sharp dresser, and she's got a sort of quite an elven pixie face, and the 60s haircut just suits her down to the ground. Almost wishes she goes from being giggly little girlfriend to femme fatale to giggly little girlfriend again, which is a bit of a shame. But she's definitely one of the more pleasing aspects of the film, not to get too wrong-headed about it. But yes, you're allowed that childhood crush, I say.
Yeah. Also, she doesn't seem too impressed with her fiance saying that he's more concerned for Godzilla than her safety.
Oh, that was awkward.
I'm more concerned about Godzilla.
Yeah, it adds a little clumsy at the beginning. it sort of takes a little bit of time just to understand the story it wants to tell. But once it's going, it's fine.
Okay. I mean, is there anything else you want to discuss about this one?
No, I just want to thank everybody who voted for it, really, because it is a hugely enjoyable film, and it's well worthy of discussion. And, you know, whilst it's not my favourite kaiju movie, it's probably my favourite of that era of the more fun, tongue-in-cheeky... I don't want to call them silly because that's unfair, but of that kind of era, for sure.
I mean, it's funny, obviously, when we look at how Godzilla is viewed, because obviously to the West, certainly in the States, Godzilla is seen as very throwaway sort of movies. He's sort of like late night monster smackdown sort of movies, and so kind of very disposable. And in Japan, the honor of being asked to direct a Godzilla movie is the same as, they view it as the same as being asked to direct a James Bond movie. It's still considered a very high honor to be offered a chance to direct a Godzilla movie. And I mean, the fact that Godzilla has his own star on the Walk of Fame in Hollywood, which is impressive in itself. And the fact that we're still talking about these movies. The popularity has never seemingly wavered. Even now, the constantly seems to be a new generation discovering. And while the American films, I think, have constantly almost but just fallen short of capturing the idea of what the Godzilla is supposed to be, it's still great the fact that we obviously have films being made in his native Japan that still are continuing to evolve and do interesting things with this character and this world. I never understood people who just obviously dismiss these films as just sort of like throw in cinema. I mean, certainly for myself, this was the entry point into the world of Asian cinema. I mean, these were the films that got me into Asian cinema in the first place. I mean, it was the films and kung fu movies like Bruce Lee films and Jackie Chan, and from there, obviously, my interests obviously evolved into other areas. But I think when I look at, obviously, what appeals to me about Asian cinema, I constantly come back to kaiju movies, and Godzilla in particular, and certainly this film has always been where I placed where it started. I mean, I'm now coming up on writing about the last 18 years I've spent writing about giant monsters stomping on Tokyo, and... for some reason, this film, it's never got old for me. It's a film I loved as a kid and I still love as an adult now. So, but further watching, I mean, what would you like to pair this with?
I'm going to go with a competitor called Godzilla, and I'm going to go for Gamera, Guardian of the Universe, from 1995. So Gamera is a giant turtle with tusks who can retract his legs and has jet engine to fly around.
But this was
like a reboot of the Gamera movies, like say in 1995, and it's a huge amount of fun. In fact, it's probably the most fun I've had with a kaiju movie, because it almost a bit like this film. There's a bit of science fiction going on. There's obviously the kaiju stuff going on, and a little bit of strange mysticism as well. And it's just, I just found it hugely enjoyable, well directed. But I know that it wouldn't appeal to many, but to me, I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I mean, Gamera is kind of is the closest competitor that Godzilla has. I mean, for years they've talked about doing Godzilla versus Gamera, and I don't think it's ever going to happen. But we can always hold out hope. I mean, Gamera, as you said, he's a fire-breathing space turtle who can fly. He's also the friend to all children. And his films are most distinctly known for being extremely violent, despite him being the friend to all children. Whereas Godzilla movies were very sort of rarely would include scenes of like violence and gore. We'd obviously get things like Godzilla vs. Gamera, where we get those like nasty slice wounds and blood splattering at the camera. Gamera movies would constantly show collateral damage, so people being blown up. Gamera himself would be horrifically injured and have these bloody wounds. And certainly with the trilogy with Guardian of the Universe started, I mean, it obviously ended with Revenge of Iris, which for my money is one of my favorite kaiju movies as well. Gamera is a fascinating character. I mean, I don't know whether his films are on par with the Godzilla movies, but they're certainly a lot of fun to watch. So that's a really great pick there.
I'm glad you think so. I was worried then.
For myself, I'm still going to stick with Godzilla. I'm going to go for another standout film in the saga, and that's Godzilla vs. King Ghidorah. This was released in 1991. And this film actually saw the return of an evil Godzilla, as it's set in, again, an alternate future where Godzilla is basically eradicated from the timeline because these time-traveling aliens turn up and warn the modern-day Japan that Godzilla is going to bring about this great destruction of the world. So they go back in time to eliminate Godzilla from the timeline. So we get to actually see Godzilla as his original form as a dinosaur, and it does feature the wonderful line after the US Navy blow up Godzilla by saying, "Take that, you dinosaur." This is a really fantastic film, and also features King Ghidorah returning as Mecha King Ghidorah. Not only, again, do we see the evil version of Godzilla, which is a nice, fun twist, we also get to see the origins of King Ghidorah as well. So it has some fun with the timeline. It throws in ideas of time travel. We get to see a cyborg who is played by Chuck Wilson, I believe, whose amazing ability to run really fast makes him look like he's reenacting Madonna's Rare Light video. Godzilla versus King Ghidorah, it's got improved effects. When they're actually attacking Godzilla, things are actually hitting it rather than just a lot of fireworks flying meters past Godzilla. And just overall, it's just a really fun film and features probably some of the most memorable moments of the franchise, and definitely one worth checking out if you enjoy destroying monsters.
I think I will do so.
Cool. And this wraps up our another episode of the Asian Cinema Film Club. Thank you again to everyone who obviously voted. And We will, of course, be back in the new year. And, Stephen, I mean, obviously, it's your turn for a pick. I mean, we've obviously had a number of theme months. We've had the Halloween draft. I mean, we've obviously had Kaiju Christmas. We could obviously go and do Kurosawa Kwanzaa or, you know, Mickey March. I don't know what you want to obviously kick off 2018 with. I mean, what would you like to have the year kick off with?
Okay, so I haven't got a wonderful alliteration to use, unfortunately. but it's something I've probably wanted to talk about since we started doing this. So one of my all-time favourite film actors, filmmakers of Asian cinema, of any cinema, of Asian cinema in particular, is Stephen Chow. So I really wanted to talk about a Stephen Chow film. And I think we're going to talk about The God of Cookery from 1996. And it'll give me a chance to talk for a long time about Stephen Chow and lots of other films, but I think it's a great entry point to him outside of the Shaolin Soccer and Kung Fu Hustle, which maybe most of our audience will be fully aware of.
Yeah, it's Stephen Chow's an interesting director. I mean, obviously, we had that double header of Shaolin Soccer and Kung Fu Hustle, and then he kind of disappeared for most Western audiences. I think there's some people who just assume that he made those two films, but he's had an extensive career, not only as a director, but as an actor as well. And yeah, God of Cookery is certainly an interesting movie, to say the least. So I'm looking forward to discussing that one because it is rather fun. So. In the meantime, obviously, if you haven't done already, please follow us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, leave us some likes or, leave us a rating on either iTunes or Podomatic, wherever you happen to be listening to this. The complete archive is available both on our website as well as part of the That Moment In podcast network, which you can find at thatmomentin.com. Stephen, if people want to come and find you, where's the best place as always?
Oh, you can get my most of my writings shown on easternkicks.com, which you advertised nicely for me earlier. And for my own stuff, you'll occasionally find something at guelorambling.wordpress.com. Or you can get me on the Twitter at LPVO.
Cool. As for myself, it's, of course, find me writing about video games and movie locations through my movie tourist series at thatmomentin.com. You can also check out my blog From the Depths of the Hell, which is fromthedepthsofthehell.blogspot.co.uk, or on Twitter, which is at Owen Jones. Thank you again, obviously, to my co-host Stephen for joining me again.
It's a pleasure as always.
And thank you everyone for listening. And we'll wish you all a very Merry Kaiju Christmas and a Happy New Year. And we will, of course, see you in 2018 for the God of Cookery.
Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas!
あなたからメリークリスマス私からメリークリスマス
サンタクロース is coming to town
ねえ聞こえてくるでしょ鈴の音がすぐそこに
サンタクロース is coming to town
待ちきれないでおやすみした子にきっと素晴らしいプレゼント待って
さああなたからメリークリスマス
私からメリークリスマス
サンタクロース is coming to town
やっほー楽しいねダイツ美味しいものがいっぱいだよ
おいイタリア歌いながら食べるな俺の部屋が汚れるだろう少しは日本を見習え
お気になさらず西洋事情にだいぶ慣れてきましたから
ねえねえダイツもっとみんな呼んでいいロマンお兄ちゃんとかボーイセンとか
後にしろまだ歌の途中だ今呼ぶと収集がつかなくなるだろう大 いたい、お前はいつも。
ああ、お二人とも、そろそろ歌が始まりますよ。
食べた
ー。さあ、あなたからメリークリスマス。私からメリークリスマス。
サンタクロース is coming to town。
ねえ、聞こえてくるでしょ、鈴の音がすぐそこに。
サンタクロース is coming to town。